business transacted and labor done, but few in Vienna worked overtime or even full-time at such things. There was a seamy side, of course. This city, like all others, had its poor, ill-fed, ill-clothed, and living in hovels. But as the greatest industrial center in Central Europe, as well as the capital of the empire, Vienna was prosperous, and this prosperity spread among the people and sifted down. The great mass of the lower middle class controlled the city politically. Labor was organizing not only trade unions, but a powerful political party of its own, the Social Democrats. There was a ferment in the life of the city, now grown to a population of 2 million. Democracy was forcing out the ancient autocracy of the Habsburgs. Education and culture were opening up to the masses, so that by the time Hitler came to Vienna in 1909, there was opportunity for a penniless young man either to get a higher education or to earn a fairly decent living, and, as one of 1 million wage earners, to live under the civilizing spell which the capital cast over its inhabitants. Was not his only friend, Kubizek, as poor and as obscure as himself, already making a name for himself in the Academy of Music? But the young Adolf did not pursue his ambition to enter the School of Architecture. It was still open for him, despite his lack of a high school diploma. Young men who showed special talent were admitted without such a certificate. But so far as is known, he made no application, nor was he interested in learning a trade or in taking any kind of regular employment. Instead, he preferred to putter about at odd jobs, shoveling snow, beating carpets, carrying bags outside the West Railroad station, occasionally for a few days working as a building laborer. In November 1909, less than a year after he arrived in Vienna to forestall fate, he was forced to abandon a furnished room in the Simon-Denk-Gasse, and for the next 4 years he lived in flophouses or in the almost equally miserable quarters of the men's hostel at 27 Meldemannstrasse in the 20th district of Vienna, near the Danube, staving off hunger by frequenting the charity soup kitchens of the city. No wonder that nearly 2 decades later he could write, "To me, Vienna, the city which to so many is the epitome of innocent pleasure, a festive playground for merrymakers, represents, I am sorry to say, merely the living memory of the saddest period of my life. Even today the city can arouse in me nothing but dismal thoughts. For me, the name of this fiacial city represents 5 years of hardship and misery. 5 years in which I was forced to earn a living, first as a day laborer, then as a small painter, a truly meager living which never sufficed to appease even my daily hunger. Always," he says of these times, "there was hunger. Hunger was then my faithful bodyguard. He never left me for a moment and partook of all I had. My life was a continual struggle with this pitiless friend." It never, however, drove him to the extremity of trying to find a regular job. As he makes clear in Mein Kampf, he had the petty bourgeoisie's gnawing fear of sliding back into the ranks of the proletariat, of the manual laborers, a fear he was later to exploit in building up the National Socialist Party on the broad foundation of the hitherto leaderless, ill-paid, neglected white-collar class, whose millions nourished the illusion that they were at least socially better off than the workers. Although Hitler says he eked out at least part of a living as a small painter, he gives no details of this work in his autobiography except to remark that in the years 1909 and 1910, he had so far improved his position that he no longer had to work as a common laborer. "By this time," he says, "I was working independently as a small draftsman and painter of watercolors." This is somewhat misleading, as is so much else of a biographical nature in Mein Kampf. Though the evidence of those who knew him at the time appears to be scarcely more trustworthy, enough of it has been pieced together to give a picture that is probably more accurate and certainly more complete. See Das Ende des Hitler-Mythos by Josef Greiner, who was personally acquainted with Hitler during part of his Vienna days. See also Hitler the Pawn by Rudolf Olden. Olden's book includes statements from Reinhold Hanisch, a Sudeten tramp, who for a time was a roommate of Hitler's in the men's hostel, and who hawked some of his paintings. Konrad Haydn, in Der Führer, also quotes material from Hanisch, including the court records of a lawsuit which Hitler brought against the tramp for cheating him out of a share of a painting which Hanisch allegedly sold for him. That Adolf Hitler was never a house painter, as his political opponents taunted him with having been, is fairly certain. At least there is no evidence that he ever followed such a trade. What he did was draw or paint crude little pictures of Vienna, usually of some well-known landmark such as St. Stephen's Cathedral, the Opera House, the Burgtheater, the Palace of Schönbrunn, or the Roman ruins in Schönbrunn Park. According to his acquaintances, he copied them from older works. Apparently he could not draw from nature. They are rather stilted and lifeless, like a beginning architect's rough and careless sketches. And the human figures, he sometimes added, are so bad as to remind one of a comic strip. I find a note of my own made once after going through a portfolio of Hitler's original sketches. Few faces, crude, one almost ghoulish face. To Haydn, they stand like tiny stuffed sacks outside the high, solemn palaces. Probably hundreds of these pitiful pieces were sold by Hitler to the petty traders to ornament a wall, to dealers who used them to fill empty picture frames on display, and to furniture makers who sometimes tacked them to the backs of cheap sofas and chairs after a fashion in Vienna in those days. Hitler could also be more commercial. He often drew posters for shopkeepers advertising such products as Teddy's perspiration powder. And there was one, perhaps turned out to make a little money at Christmas time, depicting Santa Claus selling brightly colored candles, and another showing St. Stephen's Gothic spire, which Hitler never tired of copying, rising out of a mountain of soap cakes. This was the extent of Hitler's artistic achievement, yet to the end of his life he considered himself an artist. Bohemian, he certainly looked in those vagabond years in Vienna. Those who knew him then remembered later his long black shabby overcoat, which hung down to his ankles and resembled a caftan, and which had been given him by a Hungarian Jewish old clothes dealer, a fellow inmate of the dreary men's hostel who had befriended him. They remembered his greasy black derby, which he wore the year round, his matted hair brushed down over his forehead, as in later years, and, in the back, hanging disheveled over his soiled collar, for he rarely appeared to have had a haircut or a shave, and the sides of his face and chin were usually covered with the black stubble of an incipient beard. If one can believe Hanisch, who later became something of an artist, Hitler resembled an apparition such as rarely occurs among Christians. Unlike some of the shipwrecked young men with whom he lived, he had none of the vices of youth. He neither smoked nor drank. He had nothing to do with women, not so far as can be learned because of any abnormality, but simply because of an ingrained shyness. "I believe," Hitler remarked afterward in Mein Kampf in one of his rare flashes of humor, "that those who knew me in those days took me for an eccentric." They remembered, as had his teachers, the strong, staring eyes that dominated the face and expressed something embedded in the personality that did not jibe with the miserable existence of the unwashed tramp. And they recalled that the young man, for all his laziness when it came to physical labor, was a voracious reader, spending much of his days and evenings devouring books. "At that time I read enormously and thoroughly. All the free time my work left me was employed in my studies. In this way I forged in a few years' time the foundations of a knowledge from which I still draw nourishment today." In Mein Kampf, Hitler discourses at length on the art of reading. "By reading, to be sure, I mean perhaps something different than the average member of our so-called intelligentsia. I know people who read enormously, yet whom I would not describe as well-read. True, they possess a mass of knowledge, but their brain is unable to organize and register the material they have taken in. On the other hand, a man who possesses the art of correct reading will instinctively and immediately perceive everything which, in his opinion, is worth permanently remembering, either because it is suited to his purpose or generally worth knowing. The art of reading, as of learning, is this: to retain the essential, to forget the non-essential. Only this kind of reading has meaning and purpose. Viewed in this light, my Vienna period was especially fertile and valuable." Valuable for what? Hitler's answer is that from his reading and from his life among the poor and disinherited of Vienna, he learned all that he needed to know in later life. Vienna was and remained for me the hardest, the most thorough school of my life. I had set foot in this town while still half a boy, and I left it a man, grown quiet and grave. In this period there took shape within me a world picture and a philosophy which became the granite foundation of all my acts. In addition to what I then created, I have had to learn little, and I have had to alter nothing. What, then, had he learned in the school of those hard knocks which Vienna had so generously provided? What were the ideas which he acquired there from his reading and his experience, and which, as he says, would remain essentially unaltered to the end? That they were mostly shallow and shabby, often grotesque and preposterous, and poisoned by outlandish prejudices, will become obvious on the most cursory examination. That they are important to this history as they were to the world is equally obvious, for they were to form part of the foundation for the Third Reich, which this bookish vagrant was soon to build. This book is continued on Disc 2. The budding ideas of Adolf Hitler. They were, with one exception, not original, but picked up, raw, from the churning maelstrom of Austrian politics and life in the first years of the 20th century. The Danube monarchy was dying of indigestion. For centuries, a minority of German Austrians had ruled over the polyglot empire of a dozen nationalities and stamped their language and their culture on it. But since 1848, their hold had been weakening. The minorities could not be digested. Austria was not a melting pot. In the 1860s, the Italians had broken away, and in 1867, the Hungarians had won equality with the Germans under a so-called dual monarchy. Now, as the 20th century began, the various Slav peoples, the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Serbs, the Croats, and the others, were demanding equality and at least national autonomy. Austrian politics had become dominated by the bitter quarrel of the nationalities. But this was not all. There was social revolt, too, and this often transcended the racial struggle. The disenfranchised lower classes were demanding the ballot, and the workers were insisting on the right to organize trade unions and to strike, not only for higher wages and better working conditions, but to gain their democratic political ends. Indeed, a general strike had finally brought universal manhood suffrage, and with this the end of political dominance by the Austrian Germans, who numbered but a third of the population of the Austrian half of the empire. To these developments Hitler, the fanatical young German-Austrian nationalist from Linz, was bitterly opposed. To him the empire was sinking into a foul morass. It could be saved only if the master race, the Germans, reasserted their old absolute authority. The non-German races, especially the Slavs and above all the Czechs, were an inferior people. It was up to the Germans to rule them with an iron hand. The parliament must be abolished and an end put to all the democratic nonsense. Though he took no part in politics, Hitler followed avidly the activities of the three major political parties of old Austria. The Social Democrats, the Christian Socialists, and the Pan-German Nationalists. And there now began to sport in the mind of this unkempt frequenter of the soup kitchens a political shrewdness which enabled him to see with amazing clarity the strengths and weaknesses of contemporary political movements, and which, as it matured, would make him the master politician of Germany. At first contact, he developed a furious hatred for the party of the Social Democrats. "What most repelled me," he says, "was its hostile attitude toward the struggle for the preservation of Germanism and its disgraceful courting of the Slavic comrade. In a few months I obtained what might have otherwise required decades, an understanding of a pestilential whore, cloaking herself as social virtue and brotherly love." The word whore was cut out in the second and all subsequent editions of Mein Kampf, and the noun pestilence substituted. And yet he was already intelligent enough to quench his feelings of rage against this party of the working class in order to examine carefully the reasons for its popular success. He concluded that there were several reasons, and years later he was to remember them and utilize them in building up the National Socialist Party of Germany. One day, he recounts in Mein Kampf, he witnessed a mass demonstration of Viennese workers. For nearly 2 hours I stood there watching with bated breath the gigantic human dragon slowly winding by. In oppressed anxiety, I finally left the place and sauntered homeward. At home, he began to read the Social Democratic Press, examine the speeches of its leaders, study its organization, reflect on its psychology and political techniques, and ponder the results. He came to 3 conclusions which explained to him the success of the Social Democrats. They knew how to create a mass movement without which any political party was useless. They had learned the art of propaganda among the masses. And finally, they knew the value of using what he calls spiritual and physical terror. This third lesson, though it was surely based on faulty observation and compounded of his own immense prejudices, intrigued the young Hitler. Within 10 years, he would put it to good use for his own ends. I understood the infamous spiritual terror which this movement exerts, particularly on the bourgeoisie, which is neither morally nor mentally equal to such attacks. At a given sign, it unleashes a veritable barrage of lies and slanders against whatever adversary seems most dangerous, until the nerves of the attacked persons break down. This is a tactic based on precise calculation of all human weaknesses, and its result will lead to success with almost mathematical certainty. I achieved an equal understanding of the importance of physical terror toward the individual and the masses. For while in the ranks of their supporters, the victory achieved seems a triumph of the justice of their own cause, the defeated adversary, in most cases, despairs of the success of any further resistance. No more precise analysis of Nazi tactics, as Hitler was eventually to develop them, was ever written. There were 2 political parties which strongly attracted the fledgling Hitler in Vienna, and to both of them he applied his growing power of shrewd, cold analysis. His first allegiance, he says, was to the Pan-German Nationalist Party, founded by Georg Ritter von Schirnerer, who came from the same region near Spital in Lower Austria as had Hitler's family. The Pan-Germans at that time were engaged in a last-ditch struggle for German supremacy in the multinational empire. And though Hitler thought that Schirnerer was a profound thinker and enthusiastically embraced his basic program of violent nationalism, anti-Semitism, anti-socialism, union with Germany, and opposition to the Habsburgs and the Holy See, he quickly sized up the causes for the party's failure. This movement's inadequate appreciation of the importance of the social problem cost it the truly militant mass of the people. Its entry into Parliament took away its mighty impetus and burdened it with all the weaknesses peculiar to this institution. The struggle against the Catholic Church robbed it of countless of the best elements that the nation can call its own. Though Hitler was to forget it when he came to power in Germany, one of the lessons of his Vienna years which he stresses at great length in Mein Kampf is the futility of a political party's trying to oppose the churches. Regardless of how much room for criticism there was in any religious denomination, he says, in explaining why Schirnerer's Los von Rom, away from Rome, movement was a tactical error, a political party must never for a moment lose sight of the fact that in all previous historical experience, a purely political party has never succeeded in producing a religious reformation. But it was the failure of the Pan-Germans to arouse the masses, their inability to even understand the psychology of the common people, that to Hitler constituted their biggest mistake. It is obvious from his recapitulation of the ideas that began to form in his mind when he was not much past the age of 21, that to him this was the cardinal error. He was not to repeat it when he founded his own political movement. There was another mistake of the Pan-Germans which Hitler was not to make. That was the failure to win over the support of at least some of the powerful established institutions of the nation. If not the church, then the army, say, or the cabinet, or the head of state. Unless a political movement gained such backing, the young man saw, it would be difficult if not impossible for it to assume power. This support was precisely what Hitler had the shrewdness to arrange for in the crucial January days of 1933 in Berlin, and what alone made it possible for him and his National Socialist Party to take over the rule of a great nation. There was one political leader in Vienna in Hitler's time who understood this, as well as the necessity of building a party on the foundation of the masses. This was Dr. Karl Lueger, the Burgomaster of Vienna and leader of the Christian Social Party, who, more than any other, became Hitler's political mentor, though the two never met. Hitler always regarded him as the greatest German mayor of all times, a statesman greater than all the so-called diplomats of the time. If Dr. Karl Lueger had lived in Germany, he would have been ranked among the great minds of our people. There was, to be sure, little resemblance between Hitler, as he later became, and this big, bluff, genial idol of the Viennese lower middle classes. It is true that Lueger became the most powerful politician in Austria as the head of a party which was drawn from the disgruntled petty bourgeoisie, and which made political capital, as Hitler later did, out of a raucous anti-Semitism. But Lueger, who had risen from modest circumstances and worked his way through the university, was a man of considerable intellectual attainments, and his opponents, including the Jews, readily conceded that he was at heart a decent, chivalrous, generous, and tolerant man. Stefan Zweig, the eminent Austrian Jewish writer, who was growing up in Vienna at this time, has testified that Lueger never allowed his official anti-Semitism to stop him from being helpful and friendly to the Jews. His city administration, Zweig recounted, was perfectly just and even typically democratic. The Jews who had trembled at this triumph of the anti-Semitic party continued to live with the same rights and esteem as always. This the young Hitler did not like. He thought Lueger was far too tolerant and did not appreciate the racial problem of the Jews. He resented the mayor's failure to embrace pan-Germanism and was skeptical of his Roman Catholic clericalism and his loyalty to the Habsburgs. Had not the old emperor Franz Josef twice refused to sanction Lueger's election as burgomaster? But in the end, Hitler was forced to acknowledge the genius of this man who knew how to win the support of the masses, who understood modern social problems and the importance of propaganda and oratory in swaying the multitude. Hitler could not help but admire the way Lueger dealt with the powerful church. His policy was fashioned with infinite shrewdness. And finally, Lueger was quick to make use of all available means for winning the support of long-established institutions, so as to be able to derive the greatest possible advantage for his movement from those old sources of power. Here, in a nutshell, were the ideas and techniques which Hitler was later to use in constructing his own political party and in leading it to power in Germany. His originality lay in his being the only politician of the right to apply them to the German scene after the First World War. It was then that the Nazi movement, alone among the nationalist and conservative parties, gained a great mass following, and, having achieved this, won over the support of the army, the President of the Republic, and the associations of big business, three long-established institutions of great power, which led to the chancellorship of Germany. The lessons learned in Vienna proved useful indeed. Dr. Karl Lueger had been a brilliant orator, but the pan-German party had lacked effective public speakers. Hitler took notice of this, and in Mein Kampf makes much of the importance of oratory in politics. The power which has always started the greatest religious and political avalanches in history rolling has, from time immemorial, been the magic power of the spoken word, and that alone. The broad masses of the people can be moved only by the power of speech. All great movements are popular movements, volcanic eruptions of human passions and emotional sentiments, stirred either by the cruel goddess of distress or by the firebrand of the word hurled among the masses. They are not the lemonade-like outpourings of the literary aesthetes and drawing-room heroes. Though refraining from actual participation in Austrian party politics, young Hitler already was beginning to practice his oratory on the audiences which he found in Vienna's flophouses, soup kitchens, and on its street corners. It was to develop into a talent, as this author, who later was to listen to scores of his most important speeches, can testify, more formidable than any other in the Germany between the wars, and it was to contribute in a large measure to his astounding success. And finally, in Hitler's Vienna experience, there were the Jews. In Linz, he says, there had been few Jews. At home, I do not remember having heard the word during my father's lifetime. At high school, there was a Jewish boy, but we didn't give the matter any thought. I even took them, the Jews, for Germans. According to Hitler's boyhood friend, this is not the truth. When I first met Adolf Hitler, says August Kubizek, recalling their days together in Linz, his anti-Semitism was already pronounced. Hitler was already a confirmed anti-Semite when he went to Vienna. And although his experiences in Vienna might have deepened this feeling, they certainly did not give birth to it. Then, says Hitler, I came to Vienna. Preoccupied by the abundance of my impressions, oppressed by the hardship of my own lot, I gained at first no insight into the inner stratification of the people of this gigantic city. Notwithstanding that Vienna in those days counted nearly 200,000 Jews among its 2 million inhabitants, I did not see them. The Jew was still characterized for me by nothing but his religion, and therefore on grounds of human tolerance I maintained my rejection of religious attacks in this case as in others. Consequently, the tone of the Viennese anti-Semitic press seemed to me unworthy of the cultural tradition of a great nation. One day, Hitler recounts, he went strolling through the inner city. I suddenly encountered an apparition in a black caftan and black sidelocks. Is this a Jew? Was my first thought, for to be sure they had not looked like that in Linz. I observed the man furtively and cautiously, but the longer I stared at this foreign face, scrutinizing feature for feature, the more my first question assumed a new form. Is this a German? Hitler's answer may be readily guessed. He claims, though, that before answering he decided to try to relieve my doubts by books. He buried himself in anti-Semitic literature, which had a large sale in Vienna at the time. Then he took to the streets to observe the phenomenon more closely. Wherever I went, he says, I began to see Jews, and the more I saw, the more sharply they became distinguished in my eyes from the rest of humanity. Later I often grew sick to the stomach from the smell of these caftan wearers. Next, he says, he discovered the moral stain on this chosen people. Was there any form of filth or profligacy, particularly in cultural life, without at least one Jew involved in it? If you cut even cautiously into such an abscess, you found, like a maggot in a rotting body, often dazzled by the sudden light, a kike. The Jews were largely responsible, he says he found, for prostitution and the white slave traffic. When for the first time, he relates, I recognized the Jew as the cold-hearted, shameless, and calculating director of this revolting vice traffic in the scum of the big city, a cold shudder ran down my back. There is a great deal of morbid sexuality in Hitler's ravings about the Jews. This was characteristic of Vienna's anti-Semitic press of the time, as it later was to be of the obscene Nuremberg weekly Der Stürmer, published by one of Hitler's favorite cronies, Julius Streicher, Nazi boss of Franconia, a noted pervert and one of the most unsavory characters in the Third Reich. Mein Kampf is sprinkled with lurid allusions to uncouth Jews seducing innocent Christian girls and thus adulterating their blood. Hitler can write of the nightmare vision of the seduction of hundreds of thousands of girls by repulsive, crooked-legged Jew bastards. As Rudolf Olden has pointed out, one of the roots of Hitler's anti-Semitism may have been his tortured sexual envy. Though he was in his early 20s, so far as is known, he had no relations of any kind with women during his sojourn in Vienna. Gradually, Hitler relates, I began to hate them. For me, this was the time of the greatest spiritual upheaval I have ever had to go through. I had ceased to be a weak-kneed cosmopolitan and become an anti-Semite. He was to remain a blind and fanatical one to the bitter end. His last testament, written a few hours before his death, would contain a final blast against the Jews as responsible for the war which he had started, and which was now finishing him and the Third Reich. This burning hatred, which was to infect so many Germans in that empire, would lead ultimately to a massacre so horrible and on such a scale as to leave an ugly scar on civilization that will surely last as long as man on earth. In the spring of 1913, Hitler left Vienna for good and went to live in Germany, where his heart, he says, had always been. He was 24, and to everyone except himself, he must have seemed a total failure. He had not become a painter nor an architect. He had become nothing, so far as anyone could see, but a vagabond, an eccentric, bookish one, to be sure. He had no friends, no family, no job, no home. He had, however, one thing, an unquenchable confidence in himself and a deep, burning sense of mission. Probably he left Austria to escape military service. This was not because he was a coward, but because he loathed the idea of serving in the ranks with Jews, Slavs, and other minority races of the empire. Since 1910, when he was 21, he had been subject to military service. According to Haydn, the Austrian authorities could not put their finger on him while he was in Vienna. They finally located him in Munich and ordered him to report for examination in Linz. Josef Greiner, in his Das Ende des Hitler-Mythos, publishes some of the correspondence between Hitler and the Austrian military authorities in which Hitler denies that he went to Germany to avoid Austrian military service. On the ground that he lacked funds, he requested to be allowed to take his examination in Salzburg because of its nearness to Munich. He was examined there on February 5, 1914, and found unfit for military or even auxiliary service on account of poor health. Apparently, he still had a lung ailment. His failure to report for military service until the authorities finally located him at the age of 24 must have bothered Hitler when his star rose in Germany. Greiner confirms a story that was current in anti-Nazi circles when I was in Berlin, that when the German troops occupied Austria in 1938, Hitler ordered the Gestapo to find the official papers relating to his military service. The records in Linz were searched in vain, to Hitler's mounting fury. They had been removed by a member of the local government who, after the war, showed them to Greiner. In Mein Kampf, Hitler states that he went to Munich in the spring of 1912, but this is an error. A police register lists him as living in Vienna until May 1913. His own stated reasons for leaving Austria are quite grandiose. My inner revulsion toward the Habsburg state steadily grew. I was repelled by the conglomeration of races which the capital showed me, repelled by this whole mixture of Czechs, Poles, Hungarians, Ruthenians, Serbs, and Croats, and everywhere the eternal mushroom of humanity, Jews, and more Jews. To me, the giant city seemed the embodiment of racial desecration. The longer I lived in the city, the more my hatred grew for the foreign mixture of peoples which had begun to corrode this old site of German culture. For all these reasons, a longing rose stronger and stronger in me to go at last whither since my childhood secret desires and secret love had drawn me. His destiny in that land he loved so dearly was to be such as not even he, in his wildest dreams, could have then imagined. He was and would remain until shortly before he became chancellor, technically a foreigner, an Austrian, in the German Reich. It is only as an Austrian who came of age in the last decade before the collapse of the Habsburg Empire, who failed to take root in its civilized capital, who embraced all the preposterous prejudices and hates then rife among its German-speaking extremists, and who failed to grasp what was decent and honest and honorable in the vast majority of his fellow citizens, were they Czechs or Jews or Germans, poor or well-off, artists or artisans, that Hitler can be understood. It is doubtful if any German from the north, from the Rhineland in the west, from East Prussia, or even from Bavaria in the south, could have had in his blood and mind out of any possible experience exactly the mixture of ingredients which propelled Adolf Hitler to the heights he eventually reached. To be sure, there was added a liberal touch of unpredictable genius. But in the spring of 1913, his genius had not yet shown. In Munich, as in Vienna, he remained penniless, friendless, and without a regular job. And then in the summer of 1914, the war came, snatching him, like millions of others, into its grim clutches. On August 3rd, he petitioned King Ludwig III of Bavaria for permission to volunteer in a Bavarian regiment, and it was granted. This was the heaven-sent opportunity. Now the young vagabond could satisfy not only his passion to serve his beloved adopted country in what he says he believed was a fight for its existence, to be or not to be, but he could escape from all the failures and frustrations of his personal life. "To me," he wrote in Mein Kampf, "those hours came as a deliverance from the distress that had weighed upon me during the days of my youth. I am not ashamed to say that, carried away by the enthusiasm of the moment, I sank down on my knees and thanked heaven out of the fullness of my heart for granting me the good fortune of being permitted to live in such a time. For me, as for every German, there now began the most memorable period of my life. Compared to the events of this gigantic struggle, all the past fell away into oblivion." For Hitler, the past, with all its shabbiness, loneliness, and disappointments, was to remain in the shadows, though it shaped his mind and character forever afterward. The war, which now would bring death to so many millions, brought for him, at 25, a new start in life. Chapter 2. Birth of the Nazi Party. On the dark autumn Sunday of November 10, 1918, Adolf Hitler experienced what, out of the depths of his hatred and frustration, he called the greatest villainy of the century. The expression appeared in the first German edition of Mein Kampf, but was changed to revolution in all subsequent editions. A pastor had come bearing unbelievable news for the wounded soldiers in the military hospital at Pasewalk, a small Pomeranian town northeast of Berlin, where Hitler was recovering from temporary blindness suffered in a British gas attack a month before near Ypres. That Sunday morning, the pastor informed them, the Kaiser had abdicated and fled to Holland. The day before, a republic had been proclaimed in Berlin. On the morrow, November 11th, an armistice would be signed at Compiègne, in France. The war had been lost. Germany was at the mercy of the victorious Allies. The pastor began to sob. "I could stand it no longer," Hitler says in recounting the scene. "Everything went black again before my eyes. I tottered and groped my way back to the ward, threw myself on my bunk, and dug my burning head into my blanket and pillow. So it had all been in vain. In vain all the sacrifices and privations. In vain the hours in which, with mortal fear clutching at our hearts, we nevertheless did our duty. In vain the death of 2 millions who died. Had they died for this? Did all this happen only so that a gang of wretched criminals could lay hands on the fatherland?" For the first time since he had stood at his mother's grave, he says, he broke down and wept. "I could not help it." Like millions of his fellow countrymen then and forever after, he could not accept the blunt and shattering fact that Germany had been defeated on the battlefield and had lost the war. Like millions of other Germans, too, Hitler had been a brave and courageous soldier. Later he would be accused by some political opponents of having been a coward in combat, but it must be said in fairness that there is no shred of evidence in his record for such a charge. As a dispatch runner in the 1st Company of the 16th Bavarian Reserve Infantry Regiment, he arrived at the front toward the end of October 1914 after scarcely 3 months of training, and his unit was decimated in 4 days of hard fighting at the First Battle of Ypres, where the British halted the German drive to the Channel. According to a letter Hitler wrote his Munich landlord, a tailor named Pope, his regiment was reduced in 4 days of combat from 3,500 to 600 men. Only 30 officers survived, and 4 companies had to be dissolved. During the war he was wounded twice, the first time on October 7, 1916, in the Battle of the Somme, when he was hit in the leg. After hospitalization in Germany he returned to the List Regiment, it was named after its original commander, in March 1917, and, now promoted to corporal, fought in the Battle of Arras and the 3rd Battle of Ypres during that summer. His regiment was in the thick of the fighting during the last all-out German offensive in the spring and summer of 1918. On the night of October 13th, he was caught in a heavy British gas attack on a hill south of Vervec during the last Battle of Ypres. "I stumbled back with burning eyes," he relates, "taking with me my last report of the war. A few hours later my eyes had turned into glowing coals. It had grown dark around me." He was twice decorated for bravery. In December 1914 he was awarded the Iron Cross, second class, and in August 1918 he received the Iron Cross First Class, which was rarely given to a common soldier in the old Imperial Army. One comrade in his unit testified that he won the coveted decoration for having captured 15 Englishmen single-handed. Another said it was Frenchmen. The official history of the List Regiment contains no word of any such exploit. It is silent about the individual feats of many members who received decorations. Whatever the reason, there is no doubt that Corporal Hitler earned the Iron Cross First Class. He wore it proudly to the end of his life. And yet, as soldiers go, he was a peculiar fellow, as more than one of his comrades remarked. No letters or presents from home came to him, as they did to the others. He never asked for leave. He had not even a combat soldier's interest in women. He never grumbled, as did the bravest of men, about the filth, the lice, the mud, the stench of the front line. He was the impassioned warrior, deadly serious at all times about the war's aims and Germany's manifest destiny. "We all cursed him and found him intolerable," one of the men in his company later recalled. "There was this white crow among us that didn't go along with us when we damned the war to hell." Another man described him as sitting in the corner of our mess, holding his head between his hands, in deep contemplation. Suddenly he would leap up and, running about excitedly, say that in spite of our big guns, victory would be denied us, for the invisible foes of the German people were a greater danger than the biggest cannon of the enemy. Whereupon he would launch into a vitriolic attack on these invisible foes, the Jews and the Marxists. Had he not learned in Vienna that they were the source of all evil? And indeed, had he not seen this for himself in the German homeland while convalescing from his leg wound in the middle of the war? After his discharge from the hospital at Belitz, near Berlin, he had visited the capital and then gone on to Munich. Everywhere he found scoundrels cursing the war and wishing for its quick end. Slackers abounded, and who were they but Jews? The offices, he found, were filled with Jews. Nearly every clerk was a Jew, and nearly every Jew was a clerk. In the year 1916-17, nearly the whole production was under control of Jewish finance. The Jew robbed the whole nation and pressed it beneath his domination. I saw with horror a catastrophe approaching. Hitler could not bear what he saw, and was glad, he says, to return to the front. He could bear even less the disaster which befell his beloved fatherland in November 1918. To him, as to almost all Germans, it was monstrous and undeserved. The German army had not been defeated in the field. It had been stabbed in the back by the traitors at home. Thus emerged for Hitler, as for so many Germans, a fanatical belief in the legend of the stab in the back, which, more than anything else, was to undermine the Weimar Republic and pave the way for Hitler's ultimate triumph. The legend was fraudulent. General Ludendorff, the actual leader of the high command, had insisted on September 28, 1918, on an armistice at once, and his nominal superior, Field Marshal von Hindenburg, had supported him. At a meeting of the Crown Council in Berlin on October 2, presided over by Kaiser Wilhelm II, Hindenburg had reiterated the high command's demand for an immediate truce. The army, he said, cannot wait 48 hours. In a letter written on the same day, Hindenburg flatly stated that the military situation made it imperative to stop the fighting. No mention was made of any stab in the back. Only later did Germany's great war hero subscribe to the myth. In a hearing before the Committee of Inquiry of the National Assembly on November 18, 1919, a year after the war's end, Hindenburg declared, "As an English general has very truly said, the German army was stabbed in the back." The attribution of the myth to an English general was hardly factual. Wheeler Bennett, in Wooden Titan, Hindenburg, has explained that, ironically, two British generals did have something to do, inadvertently, with the perpetration of the false legend. The first was Major General Sir Frederick Morris, whose book The Last 4 Months, published in 1919, was grossly misrepresented by reviewers in the German press as proving that the German army had been betrayed by the socialists on the home front and not been defeated in the field. The general denied this interpretation in the German press, but to no avail. Ludendorff made use of the reviews to convince Hindenburg. The other officer, says Wheeler Bennett, was Major General Malcolm, head of the British military mission in Berlin. Ludendorff was dining with the general one evening, and with his usual turgid eloquence was expatiating on how the high command had always suffered lack of support from the civilian government, and how the revolution had betrayed the army. In an effort to crystallize the meaning of Ludendorff's verbosity into a single sentence, General Malcolm asked him, "Do you mean, General, that you were stabbed in the back?" Ludendorff's eyes lit up and he leapt upon the phrase like a dog on a bone. "Stabbed in the back?" he repeated. "Yes, that's it exactly. We were stabbed in the back." In point of fact, the civilian government headed by Prince Max of Baden, which had not been told of the worsening military situation by the high command until the end of September, held out for several weeks against Ludendorff's demand for an armistice. One had to live in Germany between the wars to realize how widespread was the acceptance of this incredible legend by the German people. The facts which exposed its deceit lay all around. The Germans of the right would not face them. The culprits, they never ceased to bellow, were the November criminals, an expression which Hitler hammered into the consciousness of the people. It mattered not at all that the German army, shrewdly and cowardly, had maneuvered the Republican government into signing the armistice which the military leaders had insisted upon, and that it thereafter had advised the government to accept the peace treaty of Versailles. Nor did it seem to count that the Social Democratic Party had accepted power in 1918 only reluctantly, and only to preserve the nation from utter chaos which threatened to lead to Bolshevism. It was not responsible for the German collapse. The blame for that rested on the old order, which had held the power. A few generals were courageous enough to say so. On August 23, 1924, the Frankfurter Zeitung published an article by General Freiherr von Schöneich, analyzing the reasons for Germany's defeat. He came to the irresistible conclusion that we owe our ruin to the supremacy of our military authorities over civilian authorities. In fact, German militarism simply committed suicide. Quoted by Telford Taylor in Sword and Swastika, page 16. But millions of Germans refused to concede this. They had to find scapegoats for the defeat and for their humiliation and misery. They easily convinced themselves that they had found them in the November criminals, who had signed the surrender and established democratic government in the place of the old autocracy. The gullibility of the Germans is a subject which Hitler often harps on in Mein Kampf. He was shortly to take full advantage of it. When the pastor had left the hospital in Pasewalk that evening of November 10, 1918, there followed terrible days and even worse nights for Adolf Hitler. "I knew," he says, "that all was lost. Only fools, liars, and criminals could hope for mercy from the enemy. In these nights, hatred grew in me, hatred for those responsible for this deed, miserable and degenerate criminals. The more I tried to achieve clarity on the monstrous event in this hour, the more the shame of indignation and disgrace burned my brow. What was all the pain in my eyes compared to this misery? And then, my own fate became known to me. I decided to go into politics." As it turned out, this was a fateful decision for Hitler and for the world. The beginning of the Nazi Party. The prospects for a political career in Germany for this 30-year-old Austrian without friends or funds, without a job, with no trade or profession or any previous record of regular employment, with no experience whatsoever in politics, were less than promising, and at first, for a brief moment, Hitler realized it. "For days," he says, "I wondered what could be done, but the end of every meditation was the sober realization that I, nameless as I was, did not possess the least basis for any useful action." He had returned to Munich at the end of November 1918 to find his adopted city scarcely recognizable. Revolution had broken out here, too. The Wittelsbach king had also abdicated. Bavaria was in the hands of the Social Democrats, who had set up a Bavarian People's State under Kurt Eisner, a popular Jewish writer who had been born in Berlin. On November 7th, Eisner, a familiar figure in Munich with his great gray beard, his pince-nez, his enormous black hat, and his diminutive size, had traipsed through the streets at the head of a few hundred men and, without a shot being fired, had occupied the seat of Parliament and government and proclaimed a republic. 3 months later, he was assassinated by a young right-wing officer, Count Anton Arkovalai. The workers thereupon set up a Soviet republic, but this was short-lived. On May 1, 1919, regular army troops dispatched from Berlin and Bavarian Freikorps volunteers entered Munich and overthrew the communist regime, massacring several hundred persons, including many non-communists, in revenge for the shooting of a dozen hostages by the Soviet. Though a moderate social democratic government under Johannes Hofmann was nominally restored for the time being, the real power in Bavarian politics passed to the right. What was the right in Bavaria at this chaotic time? It was the regular army, the Reichswehr. It was the monarchists who wished the Wittelsbach back. It was a mass of conservatives who despised the democratic republic established in Berlin. And as time went on, it was above all the great mob of demobilized soldiers for whom the bottom had fallen out of the world in 1918. Uprooted men who could not find jobs or their way back to the peaceful society they had left in 1914. Men grown tough and violent through war who could not shake themselves from ingrained habit, and who, as Hitler, who for a while was one of them, would later say, became revolutionaries who favored revolution for its own sake and desired to see revolution established as a permanent condition. Armed Free Corps bands sprang up all over Germany and were secretly equipped by the Reichswehr. At first they were mainly used to fight the Poles and the Balts on the disputed eastern frontiers, but soon they were backing plots for the overthrow of the Republican regime. In March 1920, one of them, the notorious Erhard Brigade, led by a freebooter, Captain Erhard, occupied Berlin and enabled Dr. Wolfgang Kapp, a mediocre politician of the extreme right, to proclaim himself chancellor. Kapp was born in New York on July 24, 1868. The regular army, under General von Seeckt, had stood by while the President of the Republic and the government fled in disarray to Western Germany. Only a general strike by the trade unions restored the Republican government. In Munich, at the same time, a different kind of military coup d'état was more successful. On March 14, 1920, the Reichswehr overthrew the Hofmann Socialist government and installed a right-wing regime under Gustav von Kahr. And now the Bavarian capital became a magnet for all those forces in Germany which were determined to overthrow the Republic, set up an authoritarian regime, and repudiate the Diktat of Versailles. Here, the condottieri of the Free Corps, including the members of the Erhard Brigade, found a refuge and a welcome. Here, General Ludendorff settled, along with a host of other disgruntled, discharged army officers. At the war's end, Ludendorff fled to Sweden, disguised in false whiskers and blue spectacles. He returned to Germany in February 1919, writing his wife, "It would be the greatest stupidity for the revolutionaries to allow us all to remain alive. Why, if ever I come to power again, there will be no pardon. Then, with an easy conscience, I would have Ebert, Scheidemann, and company hanged and watched them dangle." Margaret Ludendorff, Als ich Ludendorffs Frau war, page 229. Ebert was the first president and Scheidemann the first chancellor of the Weimar Republic. Ludendorff, though second in command to Hindenburg, had been the virtual dictator of Germany for the last 2 years of the war. Here were plotted the political murders, among them that of Matthias Erzberger, the moderate Catholic politician who had had the courage to sign the armistice when the generals backed out, and of Walter Rathenau, the brilliant, cultured foreign minister, whom the extremists hated for being a Jew and for carrying out the national government's policy of trying to fulfill at least some of the provisions of the Versailles Treaty. It was in this fertile field in Munich that Adolf Hitler got his start. When he had come back to Munich at the end of November 1918, he had found that his battalion was in the hands of the soldiers' councils. This was so repellent to him, he says, that he decided at once to leave as soon as possible. He spent the winter doing guard duty at a prisoner of war camp at Traunstein, near the Austrian border. He was back in Munich in the spring. In Mein Kampf, he relates that he incurred the disapproval of the left-wing government, and claims that he avoided arrest only by the feat of aiming his carbine at three scoundrels who had come to fetch him. Immediately after the communist regime was overthrown, Hitler began what he terms his first more or less political activity. This consisted of giving information to the Commission of Inquiry set up by the 2nd Infantry Regiment to investigate those who shared responsibility for the brief Soviet regime in Munich. Apparently, Hitler's service on this occasion was considered valuable enough to lead the army to give him further employment. He was assigned to a job in the Press and News Bureau of the Political Department of the Army's District Command. The German army, contrary to its traditions, was now deep in politics, especially in Bavaria, where at last it had established a government to its liking. To further its conservative views, it gave the soldiers courses of political instruction, in one of which Adolf Hitler was an attentive pupil. One day, according to his own story, he intervened during a lecture in which someone had said a good word for the Jews. His anti-Semitic harangue apparently so pleased his superior officers that he was soon posted to a Munich regiment as an educational officer, a Bildungsoffizier, whose main task was to combat dangerous ideas, pacifism, socialism, democracy. Such was the army's conception of its role in the Democratic Republic it had sworn to serve. This was an important break for Hitler, the first recognition he had won in the field of politics he was now trying to enter. Above all, it gave him a chance to try out his oratorical abilities, the first prerequisite, as he had always maintained, of a successful politician. "All at once," he says, "I was offered an opportunity of speaking before a larger audience, and the thing that I had always presumed from pure feeling without knowing it was now corroborated. I could speak." The discovery pleased him greatly, even if it came as no great surprise. He had been afraid that his voice might have been permanently weakened by the gassing he had suffered at the front. Now he found it had recovered sufficiently to enable him to make himself heard at least in every corner of the small squad rooms. This was the beginning of a talent that was to make him easily the most effective orator in Germany, with a magic power, after he took to radio, to sway millions by his voice. One day in September 1919, Hitler received orders from the Army's political department to have a look at a tiny political group in Munich which called itself the German Workers' Party. The military were suspicious of workers' parties, since they were predominantly socialist or communist. But this one, it was believed, might be different. Hitler says it was entirely unknown to him. And yet he knew one of the men who was scheduled to speak at the party's meeting which he had been assigned to investigate. A few weeks before, in one of his army educational courses, he had heard a lecture by Gottfried Feder, a construction engineer and a crank in the field of economics, who had become obsessed with the idea that speculative capital, as opposed to creative and productive capital, was the root of much of Germany's economic trouble. He was for abolishing the first kind, and in 1917 had formed an organization to achieve this purpose, the German Fighting League for the Breaking of Interest Slavery. Hitler, ignorant of economics, was much impressed by Feder's lecture. He saw in Feder's appeal for the breaking of interest slavery one of the essential premises for the foundation of a new party. In Feder's lecture, he says, "I sensed a powerful slogan for this coming struggle." But at first he did not sense any importance in the German Workers' Party. He went to its meeting because he was ordered to, and after sitting through what he thought was a dull session of some 25 persons gathered in a murky room in the Sternecker Brau beer cellar, he was not impressed. It was a new organization like so many others. This was a time, he says, in which anyone who was not satisfied with developments felt called upon to found a new party. Everywhere these organizations sprang out of the ground, only to vanish silently after a time. I judged the German Workers' Party no differently. After Feder had finished speaking, Hitler was about to leave when a professor sprang up, questioned the soundness of Feder's arguments, and then proposed that Bavaria should break away from Prussia and found a South German nation with Austria. This was a popular notion in Munich at the time, but its expression aroused Hitler to a fury, and he rose to give the learned gentleman, as he later recounted, a piece of his mind. This apparently was so violent that, according to Hitler, the professor left the hall like a wet poodle, while the rest of the audience looked at the unknown young speaker with astonished faces. One man, Hitler says he did not catch his name, came leaping after him and pressed a little booklet into his hands. This man was Anton Drexler, a locksmith by trade, who may be said to have been the actual founder of NASA.